Before we go any further, I would like to take a moment to talk about our sponsor for this episode, Sawyer Products. This week, I want to share how Sawyer is using their business model to bring clean water across the globe. As we know, the essential need for water isn't just during a multi-day in the backcountry. Currently, over 1 billion people are living without access to clean water. Sawyer is on the mission to fix that. By the end of 2020, the West African country of Liberia will be the first developing country to have clean water nationwide with the help of Sawyer filters. So far, over 130,000 Sawyer filters have been implemented in households across Liberia. As clean water becomes accessible, studies have shown a reduction of diarrhea by 90% in the citizens or beneficiaries of this technology. Beyond physical health, these filters are drastically reducing the environmental impact associated with bottled and boiled water, creating a safer home and cleaner world. Access to potable water should not be taken for granted, and it's a pleasure to join Sawyer in supporting the sustainable access of this essential element. Their water filters are lightweight and easy-to-use systems that filter out more than 99% of bacteria with over a 10-year lifespan, making for long-term support systems to communities lacking access to clean water. Supporting Sawyer through the purchase of any Sawyer products helps further fund and subsidize the global water filtration initiatives and programs. Learn more about Sawyer's clean water initiatives at www.international.sawyer.com. to see how you can support ensuring that clean water is accessible to everybody. Sawyer, from the backcountry to the backyard.
I have really negative self-talk, which is very surprising to other people. I'm always like, if I say something and I think it sounded stupid, I'm like, oh my gosh, what does that person think of me? Oh, they think I'm stupid. I am stupid. And then I just fixate. It's the fixating. I was so terrified of being alone in my head and experiencing all of these weird changes that I didn't want to be alone.
I'm Grizel, and this is the season finale of Underneath It All, a podcast that tells the stories of everyday people who have or currently are experiencing mental health difficulties and how the outdoors has influenced them. Although I am a therapist, these conversations should not be confused as therapy sessions, but instead open conversations about mental health. My hope is that through these stories, you can have a better understanding of others around you, learn to accept and fully embrace your own narrative, and to continue breaking the negative stigma that has engulfed mental health. On the season finale of Underneath It All, I am so excited for you all to meet one of my favorite beings, Laura Neblack. Laura is a metalsmith living in New England with her husband Isaac and husky Minka. In 2016, Laura quit her job to start her own small business, The Wild Pine, and has been handcrafting jewelry in turquoise and silver ever since. She's an avid hiker, backcountry skier, and self-taught forager who loves tough summit climbs just as much as chill days on the river. Much of the inspiration for her work comes from time spent exploring and foraging in the White Mountains, her dog, Minka, always in tow. As Laura speaks on foraging, know that this is a deeply complex topic rooted in indigenous culture, and there are considerations to make with this that go beyond appropriation. In fact, many folks depend on food they forage in this present day. For more information on foraging responsibly, check out more links and resources located in the show notes. Heads up, there's mention of suicidal ideation in the beginning of this episode.
I got really into reading all of these foraging books, and then like going on little hikes around my neighborhood and being like, oh my gosh, you could eat that. This weed is edible. Let's make a salad out of these weeds. Oh my gosh. Like this mushroom is edible too. And then just like adding to the repertoire as time went on.
There are a lot of things that you can eat.
You can make some prickly pear juice. Because it's like you kind of have different biomes that are like wetter. So you get like a lot more plants, obviously. But It was really fun during quarantine too, because there's so many like edible weeds everywhere. Like you can do a ton of urban foraging, like curly dock, which grows in like different cracks, and you could make flour out of it and like eat brownies and stuff made with it. I feel like once we kept adding to like the foraging quiver, then we like moved on to mushrooms, and then we moved on to like elderflower liqueur and like making stuff. And it's just like, I don't know, it's just so freaking fun. I love it.
Well, yeah, because you're making something like that you see in nature into like an edible product. Your relationship with like the outdoors and stuff. You're from the Northeast, so kind of just start me where you grew up.
Oh gosh, I grew up all over. So I was actually born in Hong Kong, China. And then we moved to Ohio and then New Jersey. And so I kind of grew up a little bit in New Jersey, but then I went to college in Illinois where I met Isaac. And then we actually were wilderness guides in upstate Wisconsin. And so that's how we met. So literally I've been kind of like all over. But I do feel like we have a big tie to the Northeast, though. I never really thought that I would end up here because so many people heard about our adventurous lifestyle and were like, you guys need to go out west and you need to go live in Montana or Utah or something like that. And so we always had that on our radar. But then like work and me being hospitalized and just like family being here, like a lot of different things kept us in the Northeast. And now I like don't want to leave because I like know all of my foraging spots. Like I know where the blueberries are ripe. So we're going to go here. And then over here, we got the elderflower in the spring. And then over here, we got the wild plums and stuff like that. As cheesy as it sounds, I feel like we've kind of bloomed where we were planted, which is so surprising because if you told us that like 10 years ago, we would have laughed at you, you know?
Well, I think it's good that you love it too, right? Like if you have found things that have worked for you, why would you leave?
Yeah, dude. I mean, we do want to travel around a lot, but I just have like fallen in love with the flora and fauna out here. And as much as like, I mean, you know, like the weather sucks and like the AT is like intense.
How long have you been doing metalsmith? Tell me about how you even got into that.
It's really funny. So like I told you, I went to school. I got a liberal arts degree at a college in the Midwest. I double majored in like art and Spanish because I like never knew what I wanted to do. That was like my biggest anxiety growing up. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to be. I was like, I guess I just want to be an artist or whatever. And like my whole family would just joke that I would be the starving artist living in a box on the side of the road and that my sister with her business degree would like help me. So when I graduated, basically Isaac and I met at this camp in upstate Wisconsin. And we fell in love, and like hard and fast. And we got engaged like only a year after we had met. And we were babies, 22 and 23 when we got married. It was just like, when you know, you know. And so we got married and then moved out to Massachusetts together. And so I was like, okay, I want to do something with art. My dream job was to work for Anthropology and do like their displays. So I worked two jobs at the same time. I got a job at Trader Joe's doing the signs, the art for all of the signs at Trader Joe's. And then I also worked at Anthropology. Did that for a really long time. And then Isaac also worked at Trader Joe's. And so it got to the point where we were both working retail. We loved our jobs, but we never saw each other. It kind of became unsustainable because we had like no social life, couldn't go outside. Anxiety was super high. I kind of hit rock bottom because my mental health was really bad and I was really, really depressed. It sucked too because like we had the weekends that we did have together, we would try to maximize them and go out to the White Mountains and like hike and do all this stuff. We met as wilderness guides and a lot of my identity was in being outdoorsy. But when we'd get out and try to do these hikes on the weekends, I would like the first one that we ever went on, we got halfway down and I got super in my head and had a huge panic attack. and was like really, really embarrassed and was really hard on myself because I was like, I should be able to do this. This isn't that hard. It's only like an 8-mile backpacking trip. And Isaac was really, really nice about it. Like, we had to modify our plans and we ended up like staying in town. And this happened like a few times. And so it really bummed me out because I was like, oh my gosh, all I want to do is backpack and be in the wilderness, but I like can't because I'm so incredibly exhausted from my job and the demands of that, and I can't see my family and all that kind of stuff. And so it kind of all came to a head where we were like, we literally never see each other, something needs to change. And we didn't really know what that was, but then Isaac was like, hey, I think something to alleviate your anxiety and to make you pumped again, maybe you should take like an art class or something like that after work. And so I kind of looked into art classes in the area, and I've always been enamored with turquoise jewelry. And so I saw a metalsmithing class in the area, and Isaac was like, you can take it once a week. After work, I'll come bring you dinner. You can go to this class. It'll be great. And so I went to this class. It was like this perfect mix of like artistry and badassery, because it's like you're working with fire and hammers and like a saw and all this stuff, and then you get to make really beautiful jewelry. To use a metalsmithing pun, it sparked something within me. I became so obsessed with it that it was kind of like my escape during work. And so I thought about it all the time. And then I ended up putting all my eggs in one basket. And I was like, this is a solution. I have no clue what I'm doing. But if I could like make jewelry and sell it, and like, I'll just stay at home, I'll be able to see Isaac all the time, I'll take care of my dog. I knew nothing about metalsmithing or even running my own business, but I was like, let's just do it. This was 4 years ago. So I've been running my own business and creating jewelry for 4 years now, which is really cool.
That's so amazing. And I mean, your jewelry is so beautiful. It just seems like also you're playing with so many different like roles, it seems like, to be able to have the finished product.
I think that's why I like it so much. Growing up, I was always told that I was like super flighty and couldn't focus and all that kind of stuff. And I found that metalsmithing was actually really empowering because it's so many little tedious steps to get to the end result that I felt like I could kind of reclaim that and be like, look, I can focus. And I actually love doing all these little tiny tedious things. It's kind of like a really cool meditation sometimes where it's like you're doing the same action over and over again for hours at a time. And then I can just like think and process stuff.
So you mentioned growing up, you were told that you weren't able to focus. What could you tell me more about? What was it like growing up for you?
Yeah, I was a very emotional child, very emotional. And it's funny because now in retrospect, we know why, because of bipolar disorder. And
what type of bipolar are you diagnosed with?
I'm bipolar 2. So I believe the difference is like bipolar 1 is more significant ups, downs, not significant, but like a shorter timeline with ups and downs. Whereas like with me, it happens more gradual. So if I was like unmedicated, it would be like every 3 months. I was very anxious, but also on the flip side, like really excited and stoked on life. And so it was literally like Jekyll and Hyde, where it was either I'm like really happy, excited, getting all my friends like super pumped up in the neighborhood. And then on the other side, incredibly emotional, would have a tantrum, freak out at the drop of a hack. I don't know. Sometimes when you look back, you think of like a feeling instead of specific memories. And I would say overall, it was kind of melancholy and kind of hard. I really struggled and took a lot of things really personally. When somebody called me like, oh, you're such a pessimist, I really internalized that. Or, oh, you freak out too easily, I internalized that. And so I kind of let all those things really like weigh on me as a kid. There were a lot of challenges in my childhood too, because my mom actually has bipolar disorder and had a lot of health issues growing up. So kind of my sister and I, in a way, had to raise ourselves a little bit. My dad was very present in my life, and my mom was too when she was able to function. But most of the time, she was either really depressed or really manic and couldn't really get the help that she needed. But you wouldn't guess that if you were a stranger or like one of my friends. All my friends were like, we love your mom. My mom would always take my friends into her fold and give them advice and love on them. And she could literally talk to any stranger in the grocery store and hear their life story and be like, oh, Laura, this woman's dad has cancer and we need to pray for him. And I got her address. And I'm like, how did you get that in only 10 minutes when I was like grabbing something from one of the aisles, like for real? But on the flip side, like at home, she was like really, really depressed. And so there were multiple years of my life where like my mom wouldn't come out of her room and like literally couldn't function because she was so debilitatingly depressed. So then on the flip side too, when she was really manic, it was really confusing for us as kids and we didn't really understand it until like high school, how to deal with it. Even back when my mom was kind of diagnosed with bipolar disorder, it was back in the late 70s. And a lot of the medications for bipolar disorder only really started like coming out and working in like the 80s. It was kind of like hush hush, not talked about. So she didn't really get help until it was almost too late. I mean, really sad to talk about. But I like love, love, love my mom.
It has to be complicated because it's not her fault that she has bipolar, right? And that she didn't have the resources that she needed to be treated in the way that she needed. That has to be confusing as a kid, right? Because being a child, you need support and you need a lot from your parents. And when your parents can't give that to you because they don't have what is necessary to function, like it doesn't really matter as a kid, right? Because you have to, you're taking those messages. My follow-up question was like, what messages did you receive? Even if it wasn't like a direct message, but like indirect messages because your mom wasn't able to support you in the way that you needed.
So I think it was kind of like deal with all of your emotions really like behind closed doors, or feeling these feelings are really shameful. Because I think my mom couldn't really, it was really hard for her to be open and express some of the deepest, darkest thoughts. And so when I was having those struggles, I kind of took a nod from that and would suffer silently in my room or even like at school. Like I feel like most of high school, I was super depressed, which is so crazy because if you asked any of my high school friends, they would have had no clue because I was always like the gregarious one, the funny one, the goofy one that was like making everybody laugh and coming up with these really funny ideas of what to do in the woods or like in the theater and stuff like that. You need to check up on your funny friends, let me tell you, because you don't really know what's going on inside. And I think that was kind of how my mom was. Like, I feel like my mom and I are very similar. I identify with her a lot. And she was kind of the only one that understood and could comfort me when I would have like panic attacks or was really depressed. Like she was so great. It sucks because she's like not really with us mentally anymore. It's so complicated because it's like when you get to a certain point in your life when you're an adult, you're like, oh my gosh, these are all the ways that like she could have gotten help and stuff. But a lot of people don't, especially when you're deep in it and there aren't as many resources and there are other things that are more important or at least seem more important, the mental health gets put on the back burner. I think it was hard because she hid it all the time because she was told that she had to hide it and that it was shameful to be depressed all the time or even to be manic. That's why I want to tell my story so that like other people don't have to suffer like my mom did, you know? For me in high school, it got really bad, but I hid it so much. Suicidal ideation, cutting myself, but like not telling anybody about it. The only way I can describe it is that my emotions were so incredibly strong that I was so overwhelmed with them that I felt the only solution to get relief was to not exist anymore. The way that I describe bipolar disorder is almost like if you take a person that doesn't have mental illness and you take their emotions and then amplify them by like 100 times, that's kind of what bipolar disorder feels like. Unmedicated, I couldn't control how dark it went or how hyper I went. So like when I got really, really depressed and anxious, one thing would set me off and it would go from like, okay, this is how a normal person reacts, but then it would be lower, 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 circular thought patterns. I'm worthless. I can't do anything. This is my fault. Until like, I want to die. I should die. Like, nobody will miss me. I'm not worth anything, over like something really tiny. And so I felt like so embarrassed about it. I wouldn't really talk to anybody about it, but then confide in my mom, and my mom would get it. I found a lot more solace in college because I think I found friends that I connected with a lot more. And I just felt like it was a fresh start. I knew myself a little bit more and I knew what I wanted out of life. But the both sides were there still.
When were you able to recognize that something might be actually going on outside of just being triggered without mental illness, you know?
I mean, I always kind of knew that I had anxiety, and I actually, it got so bad in high school that I went to my doctor and they prescribed like a small amount of antidepressant, and it did help me a lot, but I never followed up on it. So I was on the same small dose of antidepressant for a super long time, and it helped until it didn't help anymore. You know what I mean? But honestly, I didn't really realize that something was really wrong until, like, I think it got so out of control. It kept escalating.
When you say escalate, like, what does that mean?
I would say the reactions, the mood swings, the depression and anxiety got a lot worse. Like, when I was a wilderness guide, I was living in close quarters with people. And so a lot of stuff came up all the time, and it was good, but also really hard. As part of staff development, we would sit around a campfire and like tell our life stories and about beginning to end and how we are the way we are. And it was kind of like through that, I broke down a lot and was told by people, I think who meant well, that you're too emotional. Your emotional processing is out of control. I don't know how to handle you.
Did you take it out on people? Like, and this is kind of trying to understand like your symptoms. Like, my depression is so moody and like snapping, short-tempered, short-fused, and I definitely take it out on Eric the most. My pattern is snap on Eric, get defensive for about 20 minutes, realize that I'm actually not fighting about anything, then acknowledge it, then immediately start crying, then immediately start apologizing, and then immediately start self-sabotaging, and then start telling myself a plethora of like worthlessness and hopelessness. So yeah, what were people seeing that made them, they chose to respond like that?
I think for me, my cycle isn't necessarily taking it out on other people. I take it out on myself. I have really negative self-talk, which is very surprising to other people. I'm always like, if I say something and I think it sounded stupid, I'm like, oh my gosh, what does that person think of me? Oh, they think I'm stupid. I am stupid. Oh my gosh, what could I have said better? And then I just fixate. It's the fixating and like the obsession. And so then the obsession, I'm already like on edge and very sensitive. So then another thing could happen. And then that's where I would just break down crying and be like, I'm worthless. I can't do anything right. Like, all those symptoms haven't gone away. Those, I still have them, even with therapy and a great psychiatrist and medication and stuff. But I think I've learned how to try to turn those statements around and kind of interrupt them so that I don't go into the downward spiral of you're useless and then wanting to hurt myself or just not exist anymore.
It was all internally for you.
Oh, so internal.
Which is even more scary because that you can hide there for a long time.
And honestly, it didn't really come out until I was living in really close quarters with all these wilderness guides, and a lot of stuff was coming up. I started becoming closer with Isaac as a friend, and he was one of the very first people that I confided in about a lot of these deep, dark thoughts and about some of the trauma that I had experienced when I was studying abroad. And then it was kind of like everything came to a head. He's been a huge, huge support. But like, even after we got back from a wilderness trip, he had planned on proposing to me in Michigan, like on Pictured Rocks, which is one of the most gorgeous places you've ever seen in your young life. And I had a panic attack, completely took it out on him because I was so tired. I was super nervous for this big life change. I loved him so, so much, but I felt like I didn't deserve that love. And I was like so messed up. And I was telling myself, like, I'm not worth it. You don't want to marry me. I'm a hot mess. I hate myself. Just had like this huge panic attack. He could have like walked away and left. I want nothing to do with you. But instead, he stopped and he hugged me and we yelled at each other for a little bit. And then he said, okay, Laura, we're going to pretend like nothing happened and we're going to get back in the car. And I was planning on giving these to you like when we got to the trailhead, and he like uncovers like this thing of flowers and like gives them to me. And he blindfolded me and I was so incredibly embarrassed. But he was like, honey, I love you. I want to marry you. I want to marry you, like panic attacks and all. I don't care. I literally don't care. And so then he let me redeem the whole proposal story, and we got out there and it was like beautiful and wonderful. And I think for a long time, even when we were engaged, I really looked back on that and was like, you ruined the proposal. It was going to be so great. It was so wonderful. But at the end of the day, I didn't realize how much that would prepare me and him for what I would go through 3 years ahead of time.
Hearing the story from Laura really hit home for me. When I first started dating Eric, actually, I was in a pretty bad spot emotionally. I was having frequent panic attacks and flashbacks that I had no control over. In retrospect, I probably shouldn't have been dating at all, but I knew I was in love with this guy as soon as I met him. But it was rough for a while. I was doing that emotional push-pull thing in order to protect him from me. And instead of leaving, which I'm kind of surprised he didn't for barely knowing me, he decided to work with me and showed me unconditional love and acceptance. I think there is something really powerful about that. When someone extends grace to you in the lowest of times, and if we choose to embrace and accept that love, and maybe even believe that we are worth loving and choosing, maybe then we can extend that same grace to ourselves. That kind of love doesn't have to come from a partner, by the way. My best friend in the entire world, Diane, has been someone who has seen every single part of me, the really, really great parts and also the really shitty parts. And she's chosen to love me relentlessly and unconditionally. As scary as it is to be honest with people we care about and let them in, when we choose to share our vulnerabilities, I think you'd be surprised to hear how much of a shared experience we have as humans, especially in regards to mental health. Plus, when we share, it helps us feel like we aren't alone in the struggle. But it can take a while to get to that point. And for Laura, it took hitting rock bottom.
So basically, we got engaged, got married, then we moved to Massachusetts, and we both were working. And then I ended up quitting and starting the Wild Pine and metalsmithing. I mean, it's normal, but through starting a small business is really difficult, especially when you're a solo entrepreneur. On one hand, loved what I was doing and was so excited. Incorporating my love for the wilderness into jewelry was like really cool. But on the flip side, I was working out of a 500 square foot apartment. I was alone every single day. I am extroverted. Second year, it got a little bit better, but then we had a lot of family issues. So my mom actually got really, really sick and almost passed away.
What kind of sickness did she have?
She has a lot going on. So bipolar disorder is like the underlining thing, but then she had a lot of physical health issues too that just exacerbated everything. And so she had chronic pain and needed some surgery and ended up being under anesthesia for too long and lost cognitive abilities. That piled with some other family stuff, piled with being really lonely. It was really hard being like, wow, the only person that I could confide in isn't there anymore. Honestly, I think one of the hardest things I've ever had to do is grieve somebody that was still alive. That was like kind of rock bottom for my depression. A lot of people thought it was situational because it kind of was. Obviously, it's one of the most devastating things. But because I have bipolar disorder, it went lower, lower, lower. And so Isaac and I tried to get therapy for me, just try to figure out what to do. And the panic attacks were just getting worse and worse. Then, so my mom was somewhat stable. Things with my business were picking up. Like friendships were getting really good. And this was like the first time, basically, I experienced the mania side of bipolar disorder. So mania for me looks like really hyper. I think I'm pretty funny when I'm manic. So making everybody laugh, not being able to sleep, just staying awake until like 4 a.m. and then maybe sleeping for like an hour. And I loved it too because I was so insanely productive. Like I would whip out like 20 pairs of ear jackets and I was getting the positive reinforcement of everybody's like, wow, you're so productive. Your work is so great. You're doing amazing. You've lost a lot of weight. You look really good. But on the flip side, I couldn't focus. I would sit down on my bench and literally push stones around for like 3 hours and get nothing done. I was like really irritable. Would snap at Isaac every so often, but he's so great. And he'd be like, you're fine. I love you. My thoughts were just like a constant spiral. And I would lay in bed awake that I just kept telling people like, man, I feel like I'm manic. Like, I feel like my mom did. And everybody would just be like, oh no, like that's totally normal. I think you're overthinking it. You're just happy because your mom is better.
Dismissing.
Yeah. And then I was trying to put all of these things in place so I could have community. And so I was meeting up with a friend on Instagram to go to this small business retreat. This was like right at the peak when I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't really eating a lot, working out a ton. And my anxiety was so insanely high that it was like amplified. Essentially, I drove halfway across the country to go meet up with this friend. I was so distracted, I added an hour and a half to my drive because I kept missing exits. And then I was like chugging coffee to stay awake. So it just like exacerbated it. I probably freaked her out because I was like, hey! So manic, super pumped to like meet other small business owners. I was like, this is gonna be great. But then I started having these like crazy delusions, which is like, I mean, is a big marker of bipolar disorder. I'm going to meet this person and we're going to be best friends. And then I'm going to start a wilderness retreat center and then we're going to do this. And it's like you have all these grandiose plans. And then I kept like breaking down, crying. And it got to the point where we were driving to the retreat. We're at a rest stop, like getting coffee. And I was like, dude, I do not feel right. I started having psychosomatic symptoms. I like was itchy all over. And I kept being like, I think I'm allergic to the cornfields out here in Indiana. And then I got a rash like on my neck. And it was just like my brain being like, something is wrong. I'm trying to get your attention. I told her, hey, dude, I do not feel okay. I know you don't know me very well, but this is not me. I'm really embarrassed. I didn't have a psychiatrist at this point, and I wish that I had in retrospect. I'm going to call my doctor. So I called my doctor. The answering service picked up. I told them what was going on, what medication I was on, where I was. And the guy on there was like, okay, you need to go to the nearest ER immediately based on the medication that you're on and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, wait, what? Why? He's like, you could potentially be poisoned. Ma'am, are you arguing with me? And I was just like, ah! And so that sent me into complete and utter panic. I literally started weeping uncontrollably, fell to the ground. All these like coffee shop patrons like came over and were like, what's going on? Are you okay? And then my friend had to drive me to the ER where I could barely stand up. And then they admitted me immediately into the psych ward and gave me like an EKG. I barely could keep my eyes open. I was so hyper and like moving a million miles a minute. It was just like da 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 da. When you get admitted into the psych ward, they take everything away from you that you could potentially harm yourself with. So they took everything away from me and I was like, I need to ground myself. What can I do to ground myself? I need to paint a pine tree because I love pine trees and pine trees make me feel at one with nature and I'll be great and it'll be fine. And so the only thing that I had in my bag that they hadn't taken away was a bottle of mascara and a notepad. I like am feverishly like painting a pine tree with a mascara wand. And then I like took a picture of myself with it. And I'm like, I want to remember this moment. That was my first experience being unable to control my impulses. It was really freaky.
So did you go back to Massachusetts after that?
Well, that's what makes it even more complicated. They deemed me as unstable. And so I got admitted to an inpatient unit. I couldn't be released until I was stable enough to fly back to Boston to get treatment there. That was the hardest, hardest thing ever. Isaac had to fly out. I could only see him for like 20 minutes a day. I was kind of put into a unit that was a catch-all, if you will, because they didn't really know what to do with me. And it was understaffed. All of the poor social workers were working overtime and were exhausted. And so I kind of almost had to take care of myself that whole week. And so I was with all of these people that were like, had way more going on. And so then it made me get in my head and be like, I am worse than I thought. I was just so paranoid, so freaked out all the time. Then came the medication. That was the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life. The doctor was just like, oh, you have bipolar disorder. I literally was only seen for 15 minutes by the psychiatrist and they prescribed me all of these meds. And I was put on a really antiquated regimen. I had like the most insane side effects ever.
That is scary.
It was really scary. I think it was also really scary for my family, friends, and Isaac because I literally couldn't function. These drugs that I was put on were really heavy-duty drugs. And they told me, you're never going to be able to drink alcohol again. You're never going to be able to drink coffee again. This is what your life is going to look like now. You're on this anti-seizure medication because like your brain is can't talk to each other. So it like helps the two hemispheres talk. Isaac was able to find an outpatient thing for me to do back in Boston and was able to like convince the people to release me so that I could fly directly back to Boston and have an outpatient program, which I think would have better suited my needs. But after that, essentially embarked on the hardest year of my life.
It's mind-boggling to me because what you just explained sounds so scary.
It was really scary, but I think what was scarier coming back into my life and feeling like a totally different person. When I got back, they took me off all those drugs. They were like, you shouldn't have been on any of these drugs. So then I had to go through withdrawal. The time I got Giardia, I would rather have Giardia than go through a medication change, which is saying a lot. Like it was just constant headaches, really weird mood swings. I had all these weird fears too. Like I ended up going through 10 different medication changes with withdrawals before we found the regimen that worked.
10?
10, dude. It was terrible.
What kind of fears did you have?
I was so terrified of being alone in my head and experiencing all of these weird changes that I didn't want to be alone. And so the scariest thing to me was going to sleep and having nobody to talk to. And then when Isaac would leave for work, I was terrified to be home alone, which is so weird because I love being home alone now. Like the only thing that got me through was like journaling, trying to eat certain things at certain times and taking Advil to make the headaches go away and trying to run, do yoga. Like I tried everything, essential oils. And it was like a little bit of everything helped, but it was so hard that I just wanted there to be one cure all be all. And I think the most devastating thing was that I couldn't even metalsmith.
For that whole year?
For like 3 months. Like I was physically okay, but my brain hurt so badly because of all these chemical changes going on that I couldn't even like pick up my torch. And so it was like mourning the fact that I couldn't do what I loved. But through all that, I ended up getting paired with a really amazing psychiatrist who essentially like changed my life. He helped get me connected with the right therapist. I actually had to go through two different therapists before I found like the right one. So this psychiatrist, I got so freaking lucky with him, who just listened to me very quietly, heard all of my symptoms, and then told me, this is going to scare you, but I am not the typical psychiatrist. I believe in it's 30% medication, 70% therapy. And so we're going to get you on the right regimen. It's going to be very difficult. We're going to titrate up meds like little by little till we get the right amount that you need. And it's going to be work, but I want you to work with your therapist. And honestly, what helped me the most was processing everything with my incredible, amazing therapist. I just want to like hug. And I think a lot of people don't realize that like have bipolar disorder or have a friend that has bipolar disorder. Is that it's like, oh, you just get thrown on medication and everything will be fine. No, it's like relearning how your brain functions and like reteaching yourself different patterns. I'm an external processor, so actually being able to open up about these things to people.
I can't imagine how hard it was to go your whole life just coping and coping and coping without any help, right? And then I can't even imagine how hard that year of therapy was for you and the medications, because to relearn something and relearn how your brain works, it sounds exhausting.
And honestly, it was absolutely terrifying for Isaac too. And he only recently we've been able to like talk about it and process it, which is honestly a huge gift for me because he couldn't talk about a lot of these things because I was so fragile. The coolest thing, Grizz, is that remember back I was telling you like when we first moved here and I had all those panic attacks? This year, because of the pandemic, have been forced to like stay here and I'm able to go and redeem those hikes. The other day, I was like so geared up and ready to hike this one and we're like hiking it and I'm like, this is great. This is awesome. 16-mile day, no big deal. And Isaac was like, do you remember the panic attack you had right here? And I'm like, oh, that's this place? No freaking way. And we had to like turn back after 2 miles. That was this weekend where we were able to hike it. It was hard, but we had so much fun. I remember I didn't want to tell anybody what happened because of the weird stigma still around bipolar disorder. I even think about that like Katy Perry song where like hot and cold, where they're like, you're bipolar. Like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder sound like the scariest a little bit to me. It was World Mental Health Day. And I was like, I feel really ready to be able to reveal and talk about what happened to me because I feel like I've healed from it to a certain extent. I feel like I want to share my story. I was terrified. And then I posted this post. I was met with nothing but, hey, me too. And I get it. And reading this story has made me like understand my husband more because he has bipolar disorder. And hey, I have bipolar disorder too. And I just for a long time thought people only like me because of the jewelry I make and my dog. And now the coolest conversations that have come out of Instagram lately have been about connecting with other people with mental health.
Yeah. I mean, the way you talk about it too, like, it really can happen to anyone. And just like the severity of what your brain does, the society we live in is just like very much go, 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 and just get over yourself, you know? And you can't. Our society shames people for having mental health illnesses so much that people like Laura and even her mom, you would never think twice that they had a mental health illness, because they've had to live in hiding for the majority of their life. But this doesn't have to be their narrative. And if you're listening to this, it doesn't have to be your narrative either. I am a sucker for stories of redemption. I love hearing how someone who was assumed to be broken beat all the odds. And I think I love these stories because, well, it gives me hope that maybe I too can face my biggest fears, which just so happens to be facing all of myself. Now knowing Laura a little more, she's such an inspiration to me, and I want to end this episode with one more story from our hero.
I can't tell you how incredible it felt to take that very first hike back home when I got out of the hospital. It was just like this super local trail. I finally was reunited with Minka, who like now literally is my therapy dog. But the joy that I felt and the relief that I felt of being well enough to be like underneath the pine trees again and watching Minka like run around and live her best husky life, it was almost like this victory. I just got through the worst time of my life. As cheesy as it sounds, the name The Wild Pine, which is my business name, took on a whole new meaning for me, where I was like, I feel like I kind of am the wild pine. Like, wild can connote like a beautiful wilderness experience, but also wild can connote you're crazy or insane. But it was almost like being able to claim that name for myself and be like, I can be like a wild pine, like deeply rooted in being outdoors and feeling empowered and happy again, even with this mental illness. Just part of me. It's not this thing that's horrible and wrong with me, you know? It's more, I don't know, it's just something to, as weird as it sounds, to like celebrate. A huge part of the healing process too was starting to learn more about foraging too, and kind of using foraging almost as like a metaphor for myself. Just think about going on like a really tough, awful climb, almost being like my mental illness in a way. Like, imagine you probably being on the AT. It's like super mosquito-y. It's buggy. You hate your life. You're like, why am I here? I want to go home. But then if you know how to identify raspberries, it's like this little like thing in the center of like a little bit of hope. Being able to see the diamond in the rough of like when things really suck and getting those little glimmers of hope, like the little raspberries or the chanterelle mushrooms, like in the midst of the hardest, most awful hike of your life, being able to interact and enjoy nature in every single facet. Being out in nature has always been like the common string throughout my life. I don't know, it just took on so much more meaning once I was able to feel fully free in it.
Laura, you beautiful being. I cannot thank you enough for sharing this open and vulnerable space with me. I feel truly honored to call you friend, and I know that this episode is going to touch so many people. If you want to learn more about Laura and follow her journey, I encourage all of you to go follow her at The Wild Pine on Instagram. Also, in the show notes, you can find resources regarding bipolar and other mental health resources. Well, that is season one of Underneath It All. I just want to thank each and every one of you who have supported me and supported this podcast. I literally cannot do it without each of you, and hearing your feedback and hearing your stories, it gets me excited to think about what's next. So if you've enjoyed this episode or enjoyed the season, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen. It's a fast and free way to support the show, and it truly does make a difference in helping other people find us. And if you're wanting to interact more with this amazing community, make sure to find us on social media. We're on Instagram at Underneath It All Pod and on Facebook, including our Facebook group for community questions, stories, and support, which you can find by searching Underneath It All Podcast. You can also follow me at _Grizel_ for Mental Health Mondays, where I talk about the balance of my own personal life and mental health. Intro music is created by a 2-person band, which includes myself. You can find our music on Spotify by searching Passiflora. Underneath It All is a production of Ravel Media. Until next time, which there will be, we're hoping you all stay safe and healthy. Bye.